everyone, and welcome to Risky Business Edition 288. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Adobe, a small company based out of the USA. You probably haven't heard of them. And on this week's show, we are taking a gigantic axe to all of the crazy hype around Blue Box's Android research announcement. It has been a shameful, shameful week for the tech media. I'm half expecting to walk outside later on and find crowds of, you know, regular consumers holding pitchforks and burning their Android devices based on the headlines we've been seeing about 99% of all Droid devices being open to attack. Tech journos and bloggers have gone cray-cray, and they don't even know it. And as you'll hear soon in our interview with J-Case, the research is cool. It's a code signing check bypass for Android install packages, but you can put down the matches and the lighter fluid. It is just not that bad. In this week's sponsor interview, we continue the conversation about code signing with Brad Arkin, the CSO of Adobe. Adobe itself had some trouble with an attacker compromising its systems and signing malware with its HSM last year. And last week, as you would have heard, someone managed to do the same thing at Opera. Only that case was much, much worse because they also jacked Opera's update machines for a short time and served up bogus installs. So that was very, 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 very bad. Now, last time Brad was on the show, he was the head of security and privacy at Adobe, so handling the operational security and code signing wasn't actually his responsibility. But it is now, so he's been doing a lot of thinking on this issue. So what do these recent developments tell us about distributed trust models for code signing? Are desktop operating systems moving towards the mobile app signing model that has worked so spectacularly well for Apple? Well, Brad says they are. And with a couple of caveats, and that's coming up later. But first up, it is time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, our good buddy Ed Snowden, just keeps giving up the goods. There's a really interesting Q&A between Jacob Applebaum and Edward Snowden that has appeared in Der Spiegel.
Yeah, so it transpires that Jake Applebaum was actually brought in by one of the reporters that was involved with, you know, originally getting Snowden out there, and they you know, trying to establish at that point his bona fides before they really knew who he was or what the story was. So this is an interview that's actually you know, kind of about, I guess, what, 2 months old now or 6 weeks old, which is interesting in that it's kind of unpolluted and sort of innocent, I guess, unpolluted by the media coverage that, of course, has now come out about Snowden and of all the other revelations. So it's actually quite an interesting read.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff in there, isn't there, about how, you know, once you've actually been selected for targeting, you get owned, PCAPs of everything that goes to and from your machines, winds up, you know, being forwarded to whatever agency. The UK has a rolling buffer of like 3 days of every packet on the internet. You know, the data center in Utah is being built to store all of this crap. I mean, there's some very, very interesting stuff in there. I'm starting to warm up to Ed Snowden, I got to admit.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that that I quite liked about this is, of course, it's yet another independent confirmation of the fact that Stuxnet was indeed the US and Israel. That was one of the questions that was asked. And yeah, you know, I think what he's doing is genuinely useful. And, you know, seeing these kind of interviews, especially, you know, before anyone knew who he was, you know, it does provide some useful, you know, some useful bits. Yeah, I think, you know, I think you're right to be warming to him.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Oh, now there's been a really funny report that popped up in the New York Times. I just thought it was worth mentioning that, you know, someone mentioned that he did his certified ethical hacker certificate to someone at the New York Times, which resulted in a story with the headline of, you know, Snowden trained as a hacker while with NSA, as if this is a course that enabled him to do all of this stuff. Just kind of a funnier than usual media fail.
It was pretty funny. Yeah, no, I read the headline and I thought, oh, this is interesting. And then it gets to the bit about the CIA, and yeah, like I just facepalmed on the spot.
Yeah, yeah, enough said on that one. Now, Snowden also has revealed Australia's links to these US spying programs. He has revealed that Pine Gap, the spy facility in Alice Springs in the middle of the desert here in Australia, is in fact a spy facility. In other news, the sky is blue and things fall down, not up.
Yeah, now this was not exactly the groundbreaking revelations we were hoping for there. And of course, this he also discussed you know, some of the other signals intercept facilities in the Five Eyes network, including of course our own New Zealand's Waihopai intercept station. It's like, well, we did kind of know that, you know, there was an echelon and we intercepted, you know, satellite microwave comms and, you know, not really a groundbreaking revelation
Well, I was interviewed by, ABC local radio in Darwin, which is the capital of the Northern Territory, which is where a lot of these facilities are actually based. And, you know, they were asking me, what do we know that that we didn't know previously? And, you know, I just said to them, well, you know, not much, but keep in mind that these leaks are not designed for us. They're designed to stimulate debate within the United States. So, you know, there's no need to really be disappointed about the lack of revelations here. I think he's trying to really shine a light on this to get Americans thinking about it, not so much Australians and New Zealands. I also told them, too, that, you know, they were asking me what level of involvement Pine Gap might have in PRISM. And I'm like, yeah, last time I checked, you know, there isn't a great deal of internet traffic being routed through Australia, let alone Alice Springs. You know, I think I think there's only something like 300,000 people in the Northern Territory. So, yeah, not a lot of traffic going through there. Unless you wanted to man in the middle some internet traffic from Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea. And I think at last count, there's probably about 36 computers there anyway.
And they're probably all owned, right?
Yeah, but not by intelligence services, probably just by, you know, skiddies. So, Anyway. Oh, now just staying with Snowden, and he has actually been offered asylum in Bolivia, Nicaragua and Venezuela. I think the big question now is how he's actually going to get there.
Well, exactly. Yeah, this is kind of the problem, isn't it? Like all of the commercial flights to that part of the world go across Europe or the US. You know, there is a flight apparently to Bolivia, you know, through Cuba or something, or through to Venezuela through Cuba. But yeah, given the experience of the Bolivian president flying across Europe, I'd be a little worried about getting on a commercial flight going across the US if I was him. So yeah, it remains to be seen exactly how effective these offers of asylum end up actually being.
Now, look, we are actually seeing some interesting developments in light of all of these revelations. And one in particular that is interesting is that Google and Microsoft are really are working to lift some of these Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court gag orders. You know, they actually want to introduce some more transparency into this process. And I get the feeling it's because they're worried that this is creating a serious image problem for them, in addition to it just being the right thing and them getting a bit, you know, shitted off at all of this government secrecy and surveillance. But it looks like, yeah, Google and Microsoft are actually teaming up with human rights organizations, civil liberties advocates, and they're trying to really move against this thing.
Yeah, they've filed a brief with the courts, along with the EFF and the ACLU and the Center for Democracy and Technology and Tech Freedom. You know, basically asking to be allowed to publish the details of the warrants that they've received. And as you said, this is, you know, I think, because, you know, this is a real credibility problem. Like, I mean, if we're going to store data in the cloud, we have to have some, you know, faith that it's not going to end up in places we didn't intend. And, you know, we only have to look at, you know, sort of the opinions of some of the Europeans, and certainly the European Union has been expressing its opinion about what this means. And, yeah, they Microsoft and Google really do have to be seen to be doing something, and they can't say no. So at least being transparent about it would be a good step to help, you know, buy them some time, I guess.
Now, in yet another tangible development to spin out of all of this, the original founders of the Pirate Bay, excluding the guy who was in prison, they actually had, they're trying to kickstart a, you know, surveillance-free messaging app, which I think is actually a really good idea. It'd be for iOS and Android, and the idea being, you know, it'd be some sort of peer-to-peer encrypted type of messaging platform where you could do, you know, verification of keywords that are passed between the handsets. And theoretically, it would be quite easy to create a secure messaging app that no one could get in the middle of. And it looks like they're doing it, and they've hit their funding target within something like 2 days.
Yeah, and this is a natural outcome of all this, and I think it is a really good thing. And, you know, we need to see, I guess, a bunch of these kinds of apps turn up. And we've seen, obviously Silent Circle has been talked about a bit recently. They have a messaging app that's similar to this. You know, having, you know, a bunch of these options available so that we can, I guess, you know, get a feel for how well they work in the real world, what the adoption's like, how difficult it is. Of course, what would be really interesting is if we saw, you know, an app like this that actually does go some way towards dealing with the traffic analysis problem, as well as the content encryption problem. If you're building an app that's going to try and defeat some of those problems, which are much newer than the traditional ones, then that would be really interesting.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that one and just see how it goes. Now, speaking of, you know, secure communication tools, CryptoCat back in the news for being crap again.
Yeah, I mean, this is the downside, I guess, of everybody's interest in crypto tools, is that building usable crypto tools, especially ones that actually deliver what they say they're doing, is very difficult. And even, you know, CryptoCats is an open source product that, you know, people have looked at before, but, you know, we're still seeing, you know, subtle but, you know, quite damaging cryptographic flaws come up. And we've seen issues with the random number generator. We've seen a number of, you know, kind of actually quite novel cryptographic attacks against. But the net result of this is, you know, people have published techniques that can decrypt CryptoCat messages within about a couple of days worth of CPU time, which is, you know, it's quite a significant attack.
It is. And that's an open source encrypted web-based chat app application that sort of anyone can use. And I think it was being sold as a, you know, secure way for dissidents to, you know, communicate securely. And it's, as it turns out, not that secure. So probably some more work needs to be done on that one. Anyway, all of these Snowden revelations do seem to be pushing crypto a lot, you know, pushing crypto into the mainstream, and I guess that's a good thing. Now, in an interesting bit of news, DEF CON has actually written a note to its on its blog to feds, asking them to please not turn up. It's, I think it goes along the lines of, we need some time apart. That's an interesting turn of events.
It is, and especially when you compare the fact that we had, you know, Keith Alexander, head of the NSA, keynoting DEF CON last year, right, to go from that to this, really, you know, it's quite a big change in the attitude. I know when I first saw this, I thought, oh, well, I mean, this is not really a, it's not really a thing. You can't really uninvite people from DEF CON. And if, you know, if none of the feds show up, then, you know, Jeff Moss is going to have to find a smaller venue, I think. But it does really kind of send a message, you know, about, you know, what we as hackers kind of feel as a community about it, and that the, you know, the sort of friendly, chummy relationship that's developed between the spook community and the hacker community, you know, in the last 10 years, you know, maybe it is going through a bit of a rough patch. And I was surprised to see this, I think.
Yeah, I think we just have to think of this as a trial separation, right? And it's especially funny considering Jeff Moss, who is the organizer of the DEF CON conference, you know, has sat on advisory boards for the Department of Homeland Security and everything. So, I mean, he's, you know, he's like a pseudo-Fed himself.
Well, exactly, right?
Yeah. You know, it's just, it's an interesting turn of events, and maybe a signal that, you know, that sort of suspicion of those intelligence agencies that, you know, had eroded within the hacker community over the last few years is sort of back. Now, there's been a major data breach. There was an attack against a Nintendo fan site that managed to breach around 25,000 accounts. Now, what makes this one kind of sad and depressing is that they were brute force attempts against accounts. Now, you would have thought if someone's brute forcing, you know, running a brute force campaign that is successful enough to compromise 25,000 accounts, they might have detected it and stopped it.
you would hope so, but on the other hand, maybe their infrastructure was, you know, very, very overpowered, and they didn't even notice the load. You know, maybe they engineered it so well.
There were 15 million failed login attempts, dude.
It is kind of sad that this kind of brute force stuff, you know, does work really well, and that they didn't notice. Although, you know, I suppose 15 million requests for 25,000 accounts—that's not too bad. You know, you run that low and slow, I think you could get away with that, even you know, even with some monitoring.
Club Nintendo apparently is the name of that site, so that's all good stuff. Oh, now this is great. Turns out, you know, these emergency alert systems that, you know, get plugged into TV stations and whatever, so, you know, fire services or, you know, the Air Force or whoever can log into them and say, you know, warning, there's a nuclear bomb coming or whatever it is, and it flashes up on the screens of everyone's TV in America. Turns out the boxes that are actually being plugged into the broadcasters ship with default SSH keys. So if you've got one of those boxes, you can pretty much, broadcast whatever the hell you want to America.
Which is it's such a classic embedded systems vulnerability. Apparently, the firmware images for a particular brand of these devices was publicly available and had the private SSH keys in them. And, is the same on every box ever. So as soon as you download the firmware image, and you're done. And, of course, we did see, a month or two ago where someone had broken into one of these systems and used it to warn of a zombie uprising.
Well, we see this every year or two, don't we? Someone actually has a crack at one of them, because it's it'd be kind of funny, man, if you were drunk enough, like watching TV.
it's proper movie hacking, isn't it? You know, hacking the emergency alert system. That's the sort of thing that Zero Cool would do.
Now, we got an interesting bit of research out of the University of California at Berkeley, which has looked at bug bounty programs and the value of them. Now, you know, we had Casey Ellis on the show talking about his business, bugcrowd.com, and, you know, his idea is he wants to do outsourced bug bounty programs for companies that, you know, don't know how to run them themselves. He has found that it's, in terms of bang for buck, it's actually very effective. Of course, he would say that, though, because that fits his marketing pitch. But now the University of California is saying much the same thing. They're saying that bug bounties give you absolutely astronomical value for money when it comes to finding bugs in externally facing properties.
Yeah, and I think this, you know, it matches what you intuitively feel, right? That the, you know, the paying out $10,000 here or $5,000 there for a bug, you know, really is a lot cheaper than paying someone to do the research full time. But of course, I guess the question is whether or not, I mean, I know, I don't think you could completely replace an internal security audit program with bug bounties, because I mean, the sorts of bugs you can find, you know, through bug bounties is somewhat limited by the way that which you can, you know, which people can attack systems from the outside.
Yeah, but in terms of a black box test, an external black box test of a web application, I mean, you know, I think these things are a really good idea.
Yeah, I think especially for hosted web applications, this makes a lot of sense. Mm. But the one wonders whether they really took into account the, you know, some of the other, I guess, non-financial costs of this. I mean, by having a bug bounty program, you're kind of authorizing people to attack your infrastructure, or at least you have to provide a sandbox or a test infrastructure that's sufficiently robust and not actually going to, you know, cause real risk to you. And that in itself can be, you know, relatively, you have to be a relatively mature organization to be able to handle that.
Well, I think that's actually one of the problems that KC is seeking to address. Do you know what I mean? Like, you actually don't directly, they don't authorize their test to attack their clients directly. They funnel everything through a VPS, you know, so that if the target wants to, they can just switch it off. And of course, they give them rules and boundaries. But this report has found that it can be up to 100 times more cost effective for finding certain types of bugs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this, you know, really is a, you know, sort of a resounding pat on the back for these kinds of programs. And, you know, hopefully we will see more widespread adoption. Because, you know, I do think they really, you know, add, they certainly add value, but I think they are, a thing that we as an industry should do more of.
Now, interestingly enough, speaking of bug bounties, Microsoft is about to pay out its first bounty for IE11 to a researcher from Google who found a bug in it.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty reasonable bug too, actually. But no, it's a bit of a turnaround for Microsoft to actually come out and be paying for these types of bugs, because all the previous programs we've seen from Microsoft have been, you know, more about mitigation technology. But yeah, so it's good to see Microsoft, you know, onto the bug bounty program, and you know, big ups to Ivan Fratrick from Google.
Staying with research out of Berkeley, and funnily enough, they have actually found. There's other research that's actually found that browser security warnings are actually proving effective these days. And, you know, I think that's, I don't know whether that's because consumers have learned or because the warnings have actually got more meaningful. You know, I mean, the SSL warnings and stuff that you used to get were so indecipherable to the average user that they would just click through them. But these days, I mean, you know, if you're using Chrome or something, the warnings are pretty damn clear. And apparently users are getting the message, and they work now.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by this. It's you know, it's not often we get heartwarming you know, tales of success to cover on the podcast, but this was quite nice. They said something like 70% of users weren't clicking through the warnings, so like 25% were actually, you know, clicking through the warnings in Chrome, and 1/3 of people in Firefox were clicking through. Which, yeah, that's quite good actually. I'm sure, you know, Peter Goodman will be very happy, as he's done a lot of work on the, you know, the sort of security usability field. I think the, as you say, the warnings are more meaningful than they used to be. Then they're, you know, people I guess are getting a little bit better educated. But yeah, the fact that they work, like who cares why? The important thing is that they are working better than they used to, and that's really good.
And, you know, more Microsoft news, a lot of Microsoft news this week. Apparently, they're going to boot vulnerable apps from their app stores, you know, both for their desktop, you know, their desktop apps, their cloud apps on the Azure store, and their mobile apps. If a vulnerability is brought to their attention and it's not patched within 6 months, goodbye, you're out.
Yeah, and I think this, you know, this does make sense, although I wouldn't want to be the, you know, the poor corporate customer who all of a sudden discovers that, you know, they've had, you know, an app blacklisted off their phone. And they're not talking about necessarily blacklisting apps, but I guess that would be, that have been installed. But I guess that would be a natural next step, right, is to go, okay, we're going to take this out of the app store and we're going to, you know, block it on people's phones in the same way we've seen them deploy the kill bit for ActiveX objects. You know, and one day you're using your Citrix client on your phone and the next minute it's gone. Like, that could be a difficult position to be in. But I think this, you know, this is a reasonable response to, you know, the kind of problems that Google have had with the Play Store.
Yeah, well, I think 6 months as well is a reasonable time frame.
That's true.
At least it's a line in the sand. And I don't think, you know, you're going to lose your Citrix client over that, but you might lose some of the more, you know, obscure apps. But I think it's just good that they're saying, you know, absolutely under no circumstances will we tolerate you know, vulnerabilities in products that you've known about for that long. And they also say in the case of active exploitation, that might change and they might just pull them immediately. So I'm guessing that means actual app revocation as well.
Perhaps, yeah. And as long as they're upfront about with you know the four developers who are developing for Windows Phone about you know exactly what the policy is going to be, then I think that could work quite well for them.
Now, Charles Sturt University here in Australia is apparently offering free CISP training via a bunch of webinars. It's a free 6-week online training course, which is being run by Craig Wright, and I think that's a really cool idea if you are interested in getting your CISP.
Yeah, I was going to say, if CISPs are your sort of thing, then well, you can't go wrong with free, I guess. So, you know, may as well take advantage of that.
I think you'd still have to pay for the exam and all of that, but, you know, the idea is they're just trying to make it easier for people to actually learn the course material.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good thing, I guess.
In some somewhat depressing news for a bunch of Australians, Symantec has shit-canned 35 staff. In Symantec's Australian tech support teams. Now, I believe what they used to do is level one support was done in India, level two support in Australia, and level three back in India, and now they've just gone India all the way. So 35 people out of a job here, which is quite unfortunate for them, I would think.
Yeah, and I guess if you're a Symantec customer, you know, a big Symantec install base, you know, it would be nice to have local people available to help you, but not anymore.
Well, you're shit out of luck. Yeah, that's right. Now, apparently that attack that we saw in South Korea back in March, that sort of economic spoiler attack when the North Korea was threatening to nuke everyone and producing all their funny videos, that was apparently the result of a 4-year malware campaign. So this isn't something that was just put together overnight. This is according to a report by McAfee.
Yeah, McAfee have basically drawn a line between, or drawn a line connecting the particular attack we saw where the master boot records of a bunch of things, a bunch of machines and banks and TV stations and things were wiped, through to some, you know, malware and campaigns being carried out by a couple of different groups. They're calling it Dark Soul, and now Operation Troy apparently is the new name. But both of these things appear to tie together you know, a series of campaigns going back as much as 4 years. Now, it's not necessarily clear that it is North Korea, but I mean, that would be the conclusion that, you know, it would be reasonable to draw. Like, it's, you know, it's either them or China, right? One would imagine that the North Koreans are well motivated. But yeah, we certainly, you know, when we talked about this at the time, we really did. You know, we called it as definitely state-sponsored, and, you know, this is a bunch more information to back that up. And, you know, you got to wonder what they got, you know, when you go scorched earth at the end of the campaign. You know, you must have got everything you needed, and that would, I would imagine, worry the South Koreans a fair bit.
Yeah, well, I doubt it was China. I mean, you know, I think China's relationship with North Korea has kind of changed a little bit. You know, North Korea's like that friend. You've been friends for a long time, but every time you go out, he's like trying to pick a fight with someone for no reason, you know, and like you keep stepping in and trying to break it up. And after a while, you kind of think it might be an idea just to sit back and let him, you know, let him get the shit kicked out of him, teach him a lesson. We're just going to whiz through some bugs very quickly. Google has fixed 17 flaws in Chrome version 28. So that will auto patch for Chrome users. Adobe is doing a July patch release, which is fixing bugs in Flash, Shockwave and Cold Fusion. There is a denial of service vulnerability patched in Apache CXF. What's CXF?
It's like an XML parser. Well, the bug is an XML parser thing. I'm not actually sure where CXF fits into the wider Apache framework. But the interesting thing, and this is one that I wanted to pick out of the rest of the bugs, this is interesting because it's actually an algorithmic complexity attack against XML parsers, which is a bug class that anytime you're implementing XML parsing, you do have to worry about. And so it's interesting seeing this one being highlighted in the media. So yes, you know, be careful how you parse things.
But is this like an Apache module or something, or is it just in base Apache?
It's the webs. This is Apache is much more than just a web server these days. They have loads of, you know, web services and all of their, you know, Java application frameworks and things. So yeah, this is the web services bit that's in their application framework, not actually the HTTP.
So much for keeping it simple. I'm feeling old right now, Adam. Thank you very much for that. We've also got a July patch Tuesday that's already, you know, come and gone. That was this week. For Microsoft, there were a bunch of bugs fixed there, including a kernel bug found by Tavis Ormandy. And apparently, attackers are already targeting one of those IE vulnerabilities, which bypasses ASLR and DEP.
Yeah, that was an interesting one because it uses Flash to set up the memory for memory corruption exploitation in IE. So that's an interesting kind of blended threat there. And, of course, does demonstrate you know, the value of some of the mitigation tech that Microsoft had put in over the years. Mm-hmm. The fact that you have to resort to doing that kind of, you know, silliness.
Yeah, well, will it blend? Yes, it will. There you go. Now, you sent me this story a few days ago, Adam, which is absolutely hilarious. A U.S. agency, the Economic Development Administration, which is an agency in the Department of Commerce, it got thoroughly owned, and the response of the administrators there was a little bit overboard.
Yeah, well, they got owned by some common garden malware. They got instructed by their political superiors to take care of it, and they hired some very expensive security consultants, as you do, to clean things up. And they spent something like $800,000 on consultancy services, and then they went the next step, which is that they then spent something like $4,000 to physically destroy all of their IT equipment, including apparently poor innocent mice were bludgeoned to death to save them from malware.
They destroyed $170,500 of IT equipment, and $688,000 was paid to contractors to assist in the development of a long-term response. But they actually wound up destroying mice. I mean, look, I know Snare is good, but Snare is not that good, okay? He has not figured out how to Trojan your mice.
Yet. Yeah, like give him a week and a couple of pints of beer. I'm sure he'll figure it out. But yes, those poor. I feel sorry for the poor mice and the monitors. Like, who kicks a monitor in?
Yeah, well, that's it. I'm amazed they didn't tie all of this stuff to stakes to begin with, because it definitely has that feel. Now, look, in a remarkably similar story, but I think this is brilliant out of the box thinking. The Kremlin has actually figured out a way to avoid some of these. I mean, DARPA has spent shitloads of money on its Cinder Cyber Insider program designed to combat internal leaks, originally in response to Bradley Manning's leaks. We can see how well that worked because Edward Snowden actually walked out with top secret material, not just secret material. So I guess Cinder wasn't actually that successful yet. But the Kremlin's approach might actually be a little bit effective, because they have just ordered a shit ton of typewriters.
Well, yeah, they are really going to solve it with that. That's a good lateral thinking. And, it does. I mean, I guess, you put things down on paper, you physically know where you are, you know when they've been stolen. This seems to make sense. Although, on the other hand, right, I think, just having a typewriter next to your computer or next to your phone may not help so much, because, we'll just see the NSA investing in, the kind of software that can listen to the audio of you typing on your keyboard and then reconstruct your keystrokes from that. But, that's they'll get there eventually, I'm sure, if the Kremlin keeps typing.
But they're literally saying that they want to increase the production of paper documents because, they're not infinitely and instantly replicable. So I don't necessarily think this is as stupid an idea as you would initially think.
Yeah, it does. It seems like a disturbingly sensible idea. And of course, if I was, Sergey Brin or Larry Page, I might be a little bit worried.
Exactly right. Yes. Neo-Luddites rise again in Russia. And Adam, that's actually all we're going to have time for this week. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
No problem, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
Insomnia security consultant Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. And do check out this week's show notes, because there's always some stuff in there that we have to cut for time. But there are links to many, many interesting things. And before we continue to this week's feature interview, it is only a couple of weeks until Vegas time. And if you have some training budget, you might want to consider booking a course with SensePost. Head over to sensepost.com/blackhat to have a look at the training courses they're offering. And SensePost has been running Black Hat courses for over 10 years now. The July 29 to 30 courses are nearly full, but there's still some availability for the July 27 and 28 courses. So sensepost.com/blackhat and tell them Pat sent you. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now, and we're chatting with a man who has the most awesome pseudonym ever, Justin Case, or J Case. And J Case is a mobile security researcher, and we're chatting to him about the Android code signing bug that we briefly touched on in the news last week. Now, since then, this vulnerability that was, worth mentioning has apparently turned into an earth-shattering bit of news. Now, if you believe the headlines, apparently 99% of all Android devices on the planet are about a hair's width away from being owned by evil hackers. Well, that is what the mainstream media seems to think. Here are some example headlines about this bug. Hackers can control almost all Android phones. There's one. Invasion of the undead Androids. Hackers can pwn nearly all devices. We can thank the Register for that one. Oh, here's a good one. 900 million Android phones vulnerable to hacking from MasterKey. And from news.com.au here in Australia comes this gem. Hackers can control almost all Android phones. Now, this sounds terrible, right? You'd think that a gigantic flaming Pwn comet was hurtling towards planet Android, but you would be wrong. All of this was kicked off by Jeff Forrestal at Blue Box Security in a blog post titled Blue Box Uncovers Android Master Key. It's a code signing bypass, but I guess when the average journalist sees the words master key next to each other, they naturally get a bit carried away. Not that it's just the media's fault. The blog post, you know, it's a little bit on the hypey side and designed to promote Blue Box's upcoming presentation at Black Hat in Las Vegas. It's the usual pre-Vegas hyped up stuff. Now, since the original post, full details of the bug have been released, and while it's interesting research, it's not nearly as serious as most media would have you believe. But despite the details being made public, there's very little out there that actually explains how an attacker might use this research to stage an attack. What can you actually do with a code signing bypass on Droid? I mean, you can't get in the middle of someone's purchase from the Play Store because it's SSL'd, so why is this a big deal? When I did my initial research on this, I learned that developers actually sign their apps with self-signed certs. I mean, that's the process. So how is a code signing bypass a big deal? The whole thing is quite confusing. Well, I got JK's on the line via Skype to ask him to explain it all. Firstly, by giving us some background on how Android app signing actually works. And here's what he had to say.
Android developer purchases their own developer account, $25 from Google. They get their access. They generate their own keys. They build their application. They sign it with their own self-signed certs. And they submit it to the Google Market. Google takes the application. They run it through Bouncer, which is a customized Android emulator, and it watches for certain behaviors like sending information off the SD card or known exploits. A couple hours later, if it passes through, it's on the market.
And so how does signing this code help at all? If you're using self-signed certs and there's no CA involved, how is that actually a security improvement?
By using the self-signed certs, it's just going to prevent updates to the application from third parties, pretty much, if that's what you're asking there. It would prevent man-in-the-middle attacks during the update process.
So updates need to be signed by the same key pair?
Yes, sir.
And that's a check that is performed, I would imagine, both at the store and on the handset itself?
Yes, sir. You can't once you've put an application in the store, you can't update it without the same key. You can't put another application with the same package name on the store. So like if you took, you know, com.jk.app and put it on the market, I couldn't come along and use the same package name.
Okay, so that's how the store differentiates between packages. So could someone with another developer account actually publish something with the same package name? Okay, right. I see. So what you've got is a bunch of developers who are signing stuff. They got, you know, self-signed certs. There's no CA process, but as soon as it's submitted to the Google Play Store, the Google Play Store works out that it's a kosher package, and then it publishes it. It records that SIG. It goes down to the handset, and if the handset gets an update, it checks the SIG and makes sure that it's legit. Now let's just talk about the update process for a minute. And of course, we've got to differentiate between the Google Play Store, third-party stores, and then also people who are just installing stuff randomly. I would imagine the update process would be different in those three cases.
The only difference is if it's not coming from the Play Store, or if it's not coming from a third-party store that has the correct install permission and is put on there by the carrier or the manufacturer, you're going to get a prompt. It's called installing it from an unknown source or third party. If you have that option enabled, it's disabled by default, so it can't happen by default. But if you disable it and you try to install it or use a third-party market like SlideMe or the Amazon App Store, you'll get a prompt that says, do you want to install this or do you want to update this? But functionally, the process is the same.
So hang on, if I've enabled third-party installs on my Android device and say someone emails me an APK and I install that, I mean, where does the code signing come into that process if there are self-signed certs? I mean, I get the way the Google Play Store actually handles this, right? But if I'm just installing, say, some malicious guy writes an app, emails it to me, I install it, am I actually going to get any warnings that are related to this thing being signed by a self-signed cert?
No. Now, if the application's already installed, it's going to refuse to install because the certificates differ. On the last couple releases of Android, Google actually sends back a hash of the application to their servers. And if it's a known piece of malware, or if it's suspect, they will warn you.
So that's the blacklisting approach that has proved so spectacularly successful over the last 15 years.
Yeah. It's not the best bet, but I mean, it's a valid bet. If people are able to install applications on their own, yeah, they're going to do it. It doesn't matter. It's okay. Like, you know, you can tell people not to download pirated Android games because there's a high chance there's malware in it. But they're going to do it anyways.
But they're still going to do it, and there's nothing that the signing of the code at that point protects. So signed code only protects people who are buying through legitimate marketplaces like Play and Amazon, and then the more sketchy the App Store gets, the more your risk level increases, correct?
Pretty much. I mean, what it protects the most is the higher privileged applications, like the applications that the manufacturers put on there. That's what it's protecting the most. That's the most critical part of what the blue box vulnerability lets us modify.
But say I come up with a package that looks like Skype, right? And I email it to someone who's got third-party updates turned on. They install that, and it's not Skype at all. There's going to be no warning to the user except for when it asks. It gives you a warning saying it's coming from an unknown source and asks for privileges. But there's no signing isn't going to help you in that case, right?
No, not at all.
Okay, so this is what confuses me about this blue box research, is because we've seen headlines all around the world this week saying, you know, the sky is falling, all Android devices are vulnerable to hackers, you know, because they found a master key problem. So what I don't get is why this is such a big issue, and the reporting on this just seems quite extreme. Can you walk us through the blue box research and tell us what it actually does?
Sure, I'm going to have to agree with you first off that I think the reporting of it's a little bit overhyped. I don't think everybody reporting on it understands it. What it is the APK files, Android applications, the container files are zip files. It's exactly what they are. The zip file format supports what's called duplicate entries, which means you could have two files, same location, same name. Most zip utilities don't support it. Most people won't run into it, but you can support it. What happens when the application is installed? Android goes to verify the signatures. And when it goes to verify the signatures, it loads, it makes a hash map, loads the file names in there as an object, and it goes to verify them. But if you have two files, same location, same file names.
It verifies the good one and lets your bad one through.
It puts the first one in there and then overwrites it with the second one. Right. So if the second one is the modified inside code, the first one overwrites it, and it will verify the second one. Say it's good, but when it's actually installed and executed, the first one is the one it uses.
Okay, so I can imagine that if I had root on the Play servers, this would be extremely useful because I could, you know, I could take Skype, load it up with a Trojan version, put it on the Play Store, and, you know, no one's going to notice anything dodgy with the signatures, and it's going to go and get pushed down to people. And that would be a very, very big problem. But practically, how is this actually a problem for users?
Right now, I mean, Google was on the ball on this. Jeff did the right thing. Jeff went to them in February and said, hey, look, I have this. This is a serious problem. Google made a patch. Google distributed it to its partners ahead of time. Google set up Bouncer to catch it so that people couldn't use it in the market. And it was taken care of. Right? The only thing that's going to come into a threat position is if somebody has, say, a secondary vulnerability, like a silent installation. So they pack the malicious app inside of another app, get it on the market, and that first app exploits another vulnerability to install it. Likely that happens small. Google will probably catch it eventually. But, you know, with Google blocking, it's not all that big of a problem. Comes more of a problem with Amazon App Store.
Just let's rewind for a second. Before Google patched this, right, how would it have been exploited?
Well, for instance, if you recall a couple months ago, Sky, the British telecom company, had their Play Store compromised, their Play Store account compromised. They were able to change the description of the app, but they weren't able to actually modify the application because they didn't have the keys to sign it with. With this vulnerability, if they'd had that, they could have taken the stock application, downloaded it, use this vulnerability to change the version number, use this vulnerability to change the actual code that gets executed, and then updated it without having to re-sign it. They have several million installs. There would have been, you know, instantly several million compromised people.
So you would require the compromise of someone's Pi account, and then you could send malicious updates to anyone with that application installed. That's bad.
That would have been the worst case scenario right there. Besides, compromising a manufacturer's key. If they compromise a manufacturer, or not key, but manufacturer's account, then it would be incredibly bad.
Okay, so I get that. Now I actually understand, because, I must have read about 15 articles on this, and never has someone actually mentioned how you might actually use this as an attack vector. Because, you can't man in the middle of play update because it's SSL protected, right?
Right. So, there'd be several things you'd have to compromise to get the whole thing done. But yeah.
Yeah, but I see now that the impact would be quite high. I mean, and let me ask you, I've never used a Play account, right? But is there two-factor? I would imagine there would be standard, Google two-factor authentication with their Google Authenticator thing for developers to log into them to prevent this sort of thing from happening and to prevent these accounts from becoming compromised.
That's what a smart developer does. That's what I do. It's not mandated, or it wasn't when I set it up a couple years ago. It wasn't mandated. I imagine a lot of them don't do it. They should, but it's just a Google account you're logging into, just like any other Google service.
But generally speaking, I mean, you would have client-sided someone to get access to their Play Store account anyway, and unless they've got their keys in a HSM, you're probably going to be able to access their build environment, steal their keys, or even submit stuff to a build server anyway, right? So,
right.
I mean, if you've owned the developer... I mean, I just don't understand how. I guess it just lowers the bar to a degree, doesn't it, between an attacker and a successful mass compromise.
Right. I mean, realistically, I mean, it's possible to do a lot of harm with this. Realistically, it's not going to happen.
Mm. So now that Google has actually fixed it, where is this? In what way is this still a big problem?
Big problem is right now I've got about 100 devices here. I've been going through them, updating them. So far, the only ones I've found that are actually protected against it are I have one of the Sony's Xperia Z tablets. It's fixed on it. HTC One I have is fixed on it. Samsung S4 has been fixed on it. The original firmware I had with the phone is fixed on it. So, I mean, they've been silently getting this out to manufacturers and taking care of it. I mean, it comes mostly into play with either user custom firmware or their developers haven't patched it, or devices have not been updated.
Okay, but how would I exploit it now that the Play Store has actually sealed this up? I get the vector through the Play Store. What are the remaining vectors, though, to actually use this bug?
First things come to mind is pirated software to gain higher privileges on the thing by pretending to be a system application or Amazon App Store, potentially. I know they... No, Amazon wouldn't work because they re-signed their application. So that's out of the picture. I guess, third-party distributed applications are the only vector here, really.
But and this brings me back to what we spoke about early on in this conversation, right? Which is that code signing, if you're installing third-party applications, doesn't actually get you anywhere in the first place. So you've always been able to send someone a dodgy APK that they will install and get a warning dialogue. I mean, how does this bug actually improve your situation if you're sending someone a Trojan third-party APK?
Third-party applications can only gain so many permissions. They're private permissions that are signature only or that are system only, which means it has to have a signature matching, let's say, platform key, or it has to be installed in the system partition. Using the blue box bug, you could modify one of those applications, and your Trojan application would actually just be a modified system application. Once you get installed third party, it would assume the role of that system application on that phone. It would have higher permissions, higher privileges. It would be running, let's say, as the radio user and be able to tamper with your phone calls. It would be running as the system user and be able to do pretty much anything.
Because I understand that even without this bug, you can send someone a third-party APK that will still have access to the processes that control text messages. I interviewed a guy recently from a company here in Australia called Datacom TSS, which is a lot of ex-government sort of agency guys, right? And they'd written one right that they use in their red teaming, where if they can trick someone into installing this APK, they can start messing with text messages and things like that. And that's not requiring this system-level privilege.
No, not at all. But I mean, with the system level privileges, you can prevent an installation of applications. You can do you can gain root access. And going from the system user to the root user is just trivial. So it'd be a much more complete compromise. It's like having a regular user account on your computer versus having your root account or administrator account.
Yeah, but you can still, I mean, we know these days you can get persistence with a user account, right? Like you can still do some pretty nasty stuff to a phone if you've, you know, tricked someone into installing an APK. I guess the reason that I'm being a bit like, you know, normally a bit of research like this, if I had have discovered the paper independently, right, I'd get in contact with the researchers and go, you know, this is interesting stuff, talk us through it. I guess the reason that my tone is a little bit ho-hum on this is just because of the absolute hype surrounding it. I mean, what do you make of that? Because it seems almost like Blue Box's PR on this was designed to confuse the mainstream press and really feed into that pre-Black Hat hype cycle. I mean, do you agree with that?
I don't know if I agree that Blue Box's PR was designed at that point. I didn't read too much into the PR. It sounds like typical security company PR to me, really. It's stuff we see all the time. What I see here is I see a lot of tech bloggers that, you know, really did not know what they're talking about and were trying to get page views. I think it was way overhyped.
It's the brave new world of online media.
It's still a very serious bug. I mean, definitely exploitable. I mean, if he had found this and wanted to use it for malicious intent without letting Google know, I mean, yeah, he could have, you know, done a lot of nasty things with it. I mean, at least it was him and not somebody that would have done that. But now that Google's taken care of it server side before it was announced, before it was made public, risk factor, I mean, the devices are still vulnerable to it, but the risk factor that actually is happening is, you know, pretty small.
But I guess it still relies, I mean, even before Google patched it, it would have still relied on you successfully compromising a developer and getting access to their Play account, right? Now, if you've done that through a client-side vulnerability, if you've done that through a client-side compromise at the developing house, you're only a hop, skip, and a jump away from their build servers anyway, right? So if you've actually taken them over to the point where you can get access to their developer account, I mean, why not just use their build servers to submit an update to the Apple Store? Do you know what I mean? It's not that much more of a...
There's one scenario where that would not be the case. Just because you have the application on your phone that came from the factory like it does not mean that application has been submitted to the Play Store. As we said earlier, you can only have one application with one unique package name on the Play Store. Now, let's say, you know, Motorola ships this phone with this really cool app. The app's not on the Play Store yet. You know, if they'd taken that application, let's say it wasn't on the Play Store, they'd modified it and submitted it to the Play Store, that's where that could have came in. They could have got it on phones without the need of actually compromising any developer account.
Okay, right. So that could have been, I see where you're going with this. This is an easy path to mass ownage. Justin, is there anything else that we should cover on this?
From a technical aspect, I think we kind of explained it. I mean, it's a serious bug, but it got overhyped by the blogosphere.
Okay, well, JKase, thank you very much for taking some time out of your day to have a chat to us here on Risky Business. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Justin Case, a.k.a. JKase there. And hey, I forgot to talk about this in the interview, but, you know, taking over a user account on a Droid device is actually extremely handy. You can actually intercept text messages before they get to the user, modify their contents before they're displayed, or you can actually siphon off the message data and then just kill the message so the user never sees it. So, you know, once you've got user-level access on Droid, you can go and do SMS resets on other accounts that user holds, and you win. And, you know, in a slightly related topic, Adam Boileau also did a really cool talk a few years ago at KiwiCon about how to get persistent and stealthy access to Unix boxes with only a user account. Because apparently during some pen tests, the clients don't want you elevating privilege to root. So he came up with a bunch of ways to hide in user accounts. They were Unix party tricks, but very, very cool stuff. Anyway, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Brad Arkin, the CSO of Adobe. And we're continuing our discussion of code signing. In September last year, an attacker managed to hack into Adobe's systems and sign some malware with their HSM. And we saw something very similar happen this month with Opera, the Opera browser. And the Opera case was actually worse because the attackers jacked Opera's update servers and used them to send out malware, which is, you know, from a software house point of view, that's about as bad as it gets. Now, at the time of the incident last year, the Adobe incident, Brad wasn't the CSO at Adobe, so the build and code signing infrastructure wasn't actually his responsibility. But it is now, so I thought I'd ask him for his reaction to the Opera thing and ask him if he thinks mainstream operating system vendors are going to start funneling all apps and packages through a central choke point a la the Apple App Store, you know, mostly because of what I see as being shortcomings in this distributed PKI model for app signing. And here's what he had to say.
If you look at what was publicly announced by Opera, and then the details of what we've talked about the Adobe code signing incident, there's a few things that jump out that are really interesting. So the same thing that happened in both environments is somebody got in and signed something with a legitimate code signing key that shouldn't have been signed. And so that happened at Adobe. It happened at Opera. One of the things that was different is that the bad guys who attacked Adobe, as far as we know, only attacked one other entity afterwards. And so it was a very targeted attack. They came here as a stepping stone to go somewhere else. Whereas the Opera one, what they were pushing was a more of a crimeware Trojan. And so they were looking for a big install base. And what's really audacious to me about this plan by the bad guys is that if they had succeeded, they would have been on, you know, how many machines is Opera installed on? 100 million or more?
Yeah, that's a lot of machines. And these guys actually managed to redirect from Opera's update servers to their malicious servers for, I think, what, about 35 minutes?
Well, yeah, so that's what the bad guys succeeded in doing in the actual attack. But if the bad guys had been able to stealthily stay on there for days and been a little bit more subtle about it, I'm curious what they would have actually done, because they would have had, you know, the biggest botnet ever. You know, 100 million plus, like, was Config or was a few million. And so I don't think their infrastructure could have handled that. So I'm curious if they'd really thought through the consequences of what they're shooting for. Mm. But anyway, so the, you know, for us, when we look at the public news about Opera, the code signing stuff, you know, we've been there. We know what that feels like. It's a little different because we had our code signing key in the HSM and they just got the signature. They weren't able to extract the whole key. Mm. But then keeping the update channel secure, that's a really big deal. And so we're watching this very closely. And you saw the Flame attack, which leveraged a way to get into the Microsoft update channel, but that was within sort of local networks. It wasn't wholesale by attacking the source.
Well, that was a really clever attack too, that one. I mean, that wasn't, wasn't actually obtaining someone's key. That was just like figuring out a flaw in the process, right?
Yeah. But the point there is that they were using legitimate update channel in order to attack computers. And so this is the next step of how you would broaden that type of attack. So we've known that update mechanisms are an attractive target because it happened with Flame. And now with Opera, we've seen it. And that's a big deal. So, you know, I think, you know, a few reactions to it. One is being a defender is hard. And even with all the precautions you put in place, things like this are still possible. Mm. And the things that we've done coming out of our code signing incident that happened about a year ago now is part of my new job is we've shifted the teams that do the operational work for things like code signing, build, release servers, the release workflows of all the hops those bits sit on as they move towards the end user computer. So all that stuff sits within my organization now. And because they work for me, in the old days, it had to be secure, it had to be performant, it had to be with the right resource allocations. There's lots of competing requirements. But now, security, number one, top priority, no hesitation, no questions. And that helps the team understand where they need to invest first. Mm. So that's something for us that, you know, the Opera scenario is something that we've really been focused on.
Well, look,
sure
I imagine politically it would have, internally at Adobe, it would have really helped the security people, because it's something where you can point at and see this is an emerging thing. But I mean, let's just talk generally about code signing for a second, because I'm, yep, you know, I know this is something that you're thinking about and that you're focused on. And now that you're CSO, this is within, you know, this is now your responsibility at Adobe. So it's probably something you're going to shake up a little bit. I mean, one of the problems that we've got with this distributed PKI model for signing code is that it makes anyone who's a trusted, you know, a trusted publisher a target, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's, you've got different degrees of trust. And so in some environments, so most environments, anything that's signed, it doesn't really matter who the publisher is. If you're looking at traditional desktop machines, and actually, no, that's just for Windows. So if you move to Mac, now they have the developer program. And so you can be a trusted developer there or not. So you have to get your license, you know, from Apple in order to be trusted for that. For the mobile platforms, then they have the choke points within the store. And
well, they're doing that on iOS 10 for anything bought through the App Store as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so you've got the Mac OS 10 on the desktop now has an option. And a lot of people turn it off, but there's enough people keeping it on where it's starting to mimic the kind of protections that you get with the modern mobile operating systems. And then with, you know, Windows App Store, Android, and with Apple, with the iOS App Store, they're all doing, you know, code signing is a big part of that in tying things to the publisher. And then they have different levels of control that they put into the App Store. So with Windows Mobile and with iOS, it's really hard to sidestep it. Whereas with Android, it's a lot different story there.
Yeah, well, as we've just heard.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, I mean, this kind of reminds me a little bit about a debate. I mean, this idea of these choke points, when Apple first did it, we said, oh my God, you're all fascists. What are you doing? You know, I mean, this was the thinking at the time. And it kind of reminded me of something that happened, you know, around 10 years ago. I mean, I can't believe it was actually that recent that it happened. I remember Howard Schmidt, who of course later went on to work for, the president, was in Australia, and I had a, you know, interesting chat with him down at, of all places, the Sydney Zoo, Taronga. And at the time, you know, Microsoft were floating this idea. I think he was there, or he might have been at eBay by that point. I can't remember. But we just wound up talking about this plan by Microsoft to introduce automatic updates, which was this whole idea of this central choke point and automated update mechanisms. And, you know, we thought about we had this long conversation about, gee, wouldn't it be really bad, you know, if someone could actually poison that update stream, wouldn't that be terrible? In other words, you know, too much central control is putting too many eggs in one basket. But I guess this is a similar example, but at the same time, it seems that putting all your eggs in one basket in this instance seems actually a much better idea, because you can just put crazy levels of control, funnel everything through a choke point that is controlled by the operating system vendor, and you wind up in a much better position. Now, for mobile apps and things like that, that's a great idea. But you guys, I mean, you told me once you're signing like hundreds of packages and updates a day to go out through your suite of products. Do you think that this is that funneling everything, even for Windows apps, through a centralized choke point is a viable alternative for contemporary software?
Well, you know, you look at the different channels. So when we ship something to the Windows Mobile App Store, I believe that those packages get signed by Microsoft in one place. And so they're really saying, you know, we verify that we've seen this and it's coming through us, through the App Store. But then when we're shipping software to, you know, Windows Desktop or other desktops, then we're signing that with our own keys and shipping it out. And I think, you know, when you look at the comparison between the two, that you're getting more assurance. And so if you buy into the Windows ecosystem, then you say, well, I feel more confident knowing that this binary flowed through the Microsoft verification process on the way to the device, whereas you get more power but more risk of bad things happening when you have distributed model. So I think, you know, the tendency, when I look internally at what we're doing at Adobe, because we're a confederation of many, many companies that have been acquired over the years, but we're looking at plucking away individual code signing capabilities or things like that might have been distributed across the company in the past. We're bringing it all centrally so we can manage it to the right level, and then it can be consistently addressed.
So first step for you guys is to reduce the complexity and actually have your own internal Adobe checkpoint instead of having, you know, one team who's signing stuff that used to be, you know, they're a legacy team from Macromedia and these guys are a legacy team from over there. You just want to have one infrastructure within Adobe where you can funnel your stuff through and you can put better controls on stuff.
Yeah, and we did that for code signing 5 or 7 years ago, and that's when we took the keys out of the disk for the individual operating systems and brought them into an HSM, and then wrapped the HSM around some access control. So we took it a certain level when we did that a few years ago, and then the next thing that we're in the process of doing is really changing dramatically the way that we do build servers, and then post-build how the release goes through the workflow in order to actually end up on the end user computer.
Because I remember when we actually initially spoke about the incident that you guys suffered, you were saying that like the oversight component was just really difficult because of the number of builds that were being submitted to be signed. So it was like quite an automated process. So you're scaling back on the automation component?
Well, yeah, what we're doing is the automation is going to stay there, except now we use internal QA keys for non-public releases. And then for anything public, then there's a manual hop in that step. So we still have to, because every team does automated builds either on demand or nightly. So we're signing an enormous volume of stuff that goes through. And what we're doing is, because we don't want to slow the teams up, they can do a QA build whenever they want.
Okay, and you've added something to the like local cert store in their machine so they can test that it's all hunky-dory and working fine.
Oh, even then, they still have to use the HSM, but we just have internal keys for that.
Yeah, okay.
So that gives us a lot more protection. And then because we now want that manual observer in the loop whenever we're going to sign something that'll be useful publicly, because that's the attack vector that's most attractive for a bad guy. Making a mistake is one thing, but making a mistake twice is totally different. So we're never going to let another code signing incident happen.
What's that saying? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Look, from a high level point of view, though, like really, it seems to me that actually submitting everything through one choke point, say Microsoft, we're going to say, all right, from now on, anything that runs on Windows gets signed by us, doesn't really seem to be a practical solution, because then they would actually have to handle the distribution of the packages as well, which would be very, very expensive. So, I mean, a lot of people are calling for that sort of central choke point, but do you think that that's something that's workable?
Well, but they're doing that for the mobile store. So they are handling.
Yeah, but I'm talking desktop stuff though.
Yeah. So for desktop, I mean, they are trying to get into that game because they have the app store for Windows 8 for the desktop, similar to what Apple's doing with the Mac store. So I think the OS vendors are willing to go down that path. But from a migration perspective, there's a lot of independent software vendors that would be uncomfortable losing that direct contact with their customers. Mm. So I think for the desktop OSs, there's always going to be effectively that side channel loading capability.
So, yeah, but I mean, as we've seen in Android, I mean, I don't know whether it comes down to their crypto model or not, but it's, you can actually install, third-party apps or whatever, but it's a non-default option. And, I guess what you're saying is you can see the OS manufacturers heading in that direction, but I guess there's going to be a transition phase, isn't there? And it's going to take a couple of years at least.
Yeah. Oh, and we're in the middle of that now. I feel like it started, whenever the Mac App Store launched is when we really started on the desktop. And then with Windows 8, Microsoft got into that at the same time. It's a trend that's happening. And the question is whether that will take over and dominate. And if, 5 years from now, desktops look just like mobile in terms of the app distribution, or if they're going to be this hybrid model that we have today.
Mm. Now you're involved in a project or a collaboration. What's it called? It's Safecode, isn't it?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Now, I imagine this is something that you would have been speaking about. Safecode is like a coalition of vendors who want to people like yourself who want to share ideas. Have you spoken to many of your contemporaries about this stuff and what are their feelings?
Yeah. So, and actually you're talking about Howard Schmidt before. He a few months ago became the new executive director for Safecode. So he attends the board's meetings and, we get to get his input on this stuff as well. And so after the code signing incident happened with Adobe, we shared a lot of details with the other ISVs that are in Safecode just to say, here's what we were doing. Here's where things fell short. Here's what the bad guys achieved. Here's their motivation. Look in your own environments and learn from this. And so a lot of folks took lessons away, and not everybody was necessarily doing things as robust as we already were, and so they had to play catch up just to get to that point. And then now that the world has proven that that alone is not enough either, then you need to keep going further. And so on the PKI front, basically PKI, I think it's a tool to provide greater assurance about the provenance for a package. And so if it's got a name and the checksum looks right, that's one level of assurance. But if it's been digitally signed by the publisher, then you have a much higher level of assurance.
If it's digitally signed by the OS manufacturer, you've got an even higher level of assurance, you'd like to think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's because you have not just the crypto there, but then also the business relationships. Because, you know, when you think about how you have to register and get an ID with Apple, you know, there's extra hoops that you'd have to jump through as a bad guy to spoof somebody. And so I think we're going to see more crypto, more attempts to leverage crypto to provide greater assurance around, you know, authenticating the provenance of binaries before you install them and execute them. But at the same time, because it's happening more often, the bad guys are going to be looking more and more for ways to circumvent that. And in the old days, you know, you could spoof something by just using a fake icon that looks like it was, you know, PDF or something like that. Now we're seeing guys having to go upstream a lot further and then even attacking the real environments. And so that type of, you know, supply chain attack is something that I think is going to be attempted more and more often. And so as defenders, you know, it's our opportunity to prepare for that and build the walls taller to try to make it harder.
I just think that, you know, there's going to come a time in the not too distant future where people aren't going to trust publisher signed code anymore. And they're really going to be looking to their OS vendors to do the signing and also to actually have a decent key revocation process, which, you know, puts everyone in a good position, because if something turns out to be dodgy, they can yank the code. Brad Arkin, that's all we're going to have time for. Thank you very much for joining us on the show, and we'll chat to you again in another 8 weeks.
All right. Thank you.
That was this week's sponsor interview with Brad Arkin there, the CSO of Adobe. And big thanks to Adobe for sponsoring this week's episode of the show. And that is it for this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. This track is an underground hip-hop track from 1996. It's an Eminem track, and it was recorded before he became completely shit. It's off his tragically underrated 1996 independent debut album, Infinite. And you know what? I pretty much hate everything he's done since the Slim Shady EP in 1997. I mean, bits of the Marshall Mathers LP were pretty good, but, you know, Dido? Are you kidding me? But Infinite, it's actually a great album. It only sold 1,000 copies when it was released. And unfortunately, as far as I can tell, you can't actually buy this one anywhere because it was an independent release and now it's out of press. The rest of this album is also fantastic, even if the production values aren't great. So here it is, a track from the album Infinite. It's called Backstabber, and I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. There's a Joker on the loose from the psychiatric ward. His face is up on a bulletin board with a report. He'll stab you with a sword. Don't be fooled by his charm. He's probably armed with attempt to do bodily harm. Ring the alarm. Look for a man with green hair. Check at your girl's house. He was last seen there. He has a mean stare, but usually cracks jokes. Good luck on your mission and guard your backs, folks. Keep us all informed, suited up head to toe in detective uniforms. Our unit storms in, we split together in sectors, locking down every block and put up metal detectors. Protect us and be sure that you stand close. Watch each other's backs and guard your command post. And most of all, be advised that he's wise. He could be disguised as one of your very own guys. Defining personally to settle the score and to beat him unmercifully for what he first did to me. It's sure to be the last, following footprints with a magnifying glass. The dragon's like an ass back to his padded cell. I'm mad as hell on the trail of this tattletale. I heard a yell, the voice sounded familiar. Give me your girlfriend or I'm gonna kill ya. Down a flight of steps, sneezing the dust and swinging at the spider webs inside the depths of his basement. I taste lint in my mouth, then the lights in the place went. I saw my light flash in front of my eyes. I felt a butcher knife slash in one of my thighs. None of my guys knew where I'm at. I was doomed. Then I remembered the flashlight in my costume. Was one thing I learned. They're only powerful when you got your back turned. I yearned for the day that we finally met again, so I could give him a taste of his own medicine. He shed his skin, then he promised to come clean. I took his butcher knife and jabbed it into his spleen, cuffed him at the scene and dragged the fella